supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. In the wake of several high-profile mass shootings, New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy hopes to stem the flow of illegal guns coming from other states with looser gun laws. Though, as WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports, some are finding fault with the governor's strategy to name and shame those nearby states.
That strategy involves regularly releasing data about the guns recovered by police, including information about the states where the guns were bought. Governor Murphy released the first report this week. It showed that most crime guns recovered in New Jersey, 77% of them, came from other states, states with looser gun laws.
The most, 83, did not travel far. They crossed the Delaware River from Pennsylvania.
Joe Vince has experience tracing guns as a former agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, or ATF. He says traffickers hoping to sell guns in the Garden State will buy them in a nearby state where the gun laws are more open, like Pennsylvania.
It's because I can go there and I can get them much cheaper. I don't have any questions asked or very few. It's easier for me to do it, and then I transport it.
Vince praised Murphy for calling attention to how a state's gun laws can influence national trends in firearms trafficking. But others said just knowing where a gun was first bought omits important context. Here's William Vizard, another former ATF agent.
How old are they? How long has it been since they were purchased? What was the reason they were recovered? Were they recovered off people who are active criminal offenders? Were they just found in a field somewhere?
For instance, the report doesn't show whether a gun was originally bought for recreation and ended up in the wrong hands, or was bought for the purpose of being resold illegally. Still, both former federal agents noted that publicly shaming states with lax gun laws has worked before. In the early 1990s, Virginia was developing a reputation as a hub for gun trafficking, so legislators there passed a law limiting residents to buying one handgun per month. Supporters said it worked, that fewer guns bought in Virginia were showing up at crime scenes in other states. But in 2012, state lawmakers said the rule had become redundant as the prevalence of federal background checks grew, so they repealed it. In the first 3 months of this year, on the list of the top source states for crime guns in New Jersey, Virginia was number 4. From the New Jersey desk, Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
2018 is being called the Year of the Woman in Politics, and Tuesday's Pennsylvania primary ballot will feature plenty of Democratic women. Many first-time congressional candidates inspired to counter the election of President Donald Trump. WHYY's Dave Davies reports that in some races, these women are finding their toughest competition is other female candidates.
Mary Gay Scanlon, I'm running for Congress in our brand new 5th Congressional District.
Nice to meet you.
Canvassing in South Philadelphia Sunday, candidate Mary Gay Scanlon, one of 10 candidates in a redrawn district that's mostly Delaware County, makes her pitch to voters. Then she happens upon fourth grader Kylie Grayson, who has an opinion about this gender thing.
We need a woman president. We need to make history. There's no women's. It's 2018. We need a change.
There's a national wave of women running for office, and many, like Scanlon, find themselves in a Democratic primary with other progressive women they mostly respect and agree with, but have to defeat in order to advance to the general election. They aren't attacking each other in Scanlon's race, but they try to draw distinctions, each emphasizing her unique experience and ability. Scanlon says unlike first-time candidates, she's served in local government, chaired a school board. And that matters.
So I've done that work representing constituents, dealing with budgets, having been elected to office and actually running for office in a contested election. You have to learn some lessons. So I think there is a sweet spot in the current environment for a woman who has been elected before but is not a career politician.
Scanlon's one of two women in the race who've raised enough money to run robust campaigns and make significant TV ad buys. The other is former federal prosecutor Ashley Lunkenheimer. She says she's put gun runners and con artists who swindle seniors in jail, but she says she's not just a prosecutor. She made a conscious decision to get a master's in social work before going to law school.
So I've advocated for children in foster care. I've advocated for individuals with mental health issues and trying to break a cycle of being institutionalized and then discharged to a shelter. I've gone into prisons and taught decision-making skills to try to help people re-enter.
Also in the race is Molly Sheehan, a first-time candidate with an activist base, and Margot Davidson, a state representative who notes she's the only female elected official in the race. She said at a recent debate her priority is serving the most impoverished parts of the suburban district.
I'm about the people that are suffering the most, and that's who I'll be representing, although I will be nice to all of the folks in the other parts of the county, and I will be there to serve them and serve them well. But my focus will be on the folks that have been voiceless.
There are two other women and four men in the race, including veteran state representative Greg Vitale and Rich Laser, who's benefited from more than $600,000 in spending by construction unions. Nobody's suggesting that anyone sacrifice her ambitions to prevent a man from winning. But something like that did happen in the Democratic primary in the 4th congressional race in neighboring Montgomery County. Three progressive women filed to run there, along with one man, former Congressman Joe Huffel, who had high name recognition from his past days in office. One candidate, State Representative Mary Jo Daly, says there came a point where she took a hard look at the dynamics of the race.
And I thought, you know, I really would like to see a woman. It looks like we are going to be splitting votes between us.
So she made a painful decision.
What I can do to at least give better odds to my colleague was to withdraw from the race and throw my support behind her.
Daly supports State Representative Madeline Dean, who also has the backing of the national group Emily's List. And that didn't sit well with the other progressive woman in the race, Shira Goodman, a leading gun control activist. Goodman had also sought Emily's List support and had been giving the group detailed information about her fundraising and strategy to prove she was a viable candidate. After a strong showing in the April fundraising reports, Goodman says, Emily's List suddenly endorsed her rival, Dean.
We were blindsided because their mission is to support pro-choice women and help them get elected to office, and they usually do not get involved when there's more than one such woman in a race.
Emily's List didn't just endorse Dean. The group's super PAC has so far spent nearly $250,000 on mailings for her. It feels, Goodman says, like they put a finger on the scale. Emily's List does sometimes take sides in primaries with multiple progressive women. Spokeswoman Julie McLean Downey says this year is a little unusual, but
the fact that so many women are stepping up to run for office this cycle, some of them in the same districts, we see as a good problem to have.
It means some tough choices, McLean Downey says, and in this case, Emily's List decided Dean was the right candidate to back. There are disappointed candidates in every election season, and this year, with more women running, more of them are going to be women. But it's also likely that women, probably more than one, will go to Congress from Pennsylvania and end the state delegation status as an 18-member all-boys club. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
A newly released nationwide survey finds that some 4 of 10 respondents in the Philadelphia region are lonely. And that's good news compared to the country as a whole. Let's take a closer look at the numbers with Dr. Catherine Dalsgaard, Clinical Director of the Anxiety Behaviors Clinic at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Dr. Dalsgaard, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Let's start with a clinical definition of that term, lonely.
Loneliness is an interesting feeling. It's a painful emotion that, like all painful emotions, exists or has evolved to motivate us to change our behavior so that we're no longer feeling uncomfortable. Of course, not every painful emotion can be escaped, and I don't think that any psychologist would ever recommend that. Some painful emotions just have to be, and we have to feel them. But loneliness is an interesting one in that we know that social relationships, true social relationships, where you have friends and you have family and you interact with them face-to-face, those kinds of relationships are the most linked to a happy life. So loneliness is one of those painful emotions that says, or should say to people, I'm missing out. I want more human connection, and I'm motivated now to reach out and get that human connection.
The study interestingly finds that the younger one gets, at least in terms of these respondents, the more one is apt to feel lonesome. It breaks a widely held notion that it's senior citizens who feel more isolated.
Yes, and I think that that's the good news of Cygnus study. The study is cross-sectional, meaning they asked everyone at the same time, Gen Z adults, 18 to 22-year-olds, Generation Y, Generation X, baby boomers, and the greatest generation, who are now, I think, above 72 years old. And what Cygnus found was that the lowest levels of loneliness were reported by the oldest respondents, that is, the greatest generation, those who are ages 72 and up. The second loneliest reporters were baby boomers, the ages 52 to 71-year-olds, and then on down the list, so that as people got younger, they were reporting more loneliness.
Presumably, this Cygnus study only solicited responses from adults, and your population that you work with, children, presumably weren't included. What are you finding among those who you work with?
What I find among my kids is that reports of loneliness quite often are comorbid or coincide with reports of feeling sad and depressed. And I don't think that that's an accident. One of the things that happens when children and adults become depressed is they begin to socially withdraw. And that's a real problem because social withdrawal leads to further unhappiness, which leads to further loneliness, which leads to further sadness.
What's the correlation between that withdrawal and turning to social media?
The correlation is very high. I'm a big fan of social media. However, social media is one of those socially non-nutritious activities that's easy to engage in because it's a passive activity, but later on it can make you feel kind of icky. And because it's easy and because it's passive, many people who are feeling sad will use it as a means of perking their mood up temporarily.
So many studies point to the general breakdown of institutions, including family, church. Are those connectives important to help maintain perspective, and are they in turn a cause for increased loneliness?
I think that's unequivocal, and we've been finding more and more that as America ages into the 21st century, but even in the last half of the 20th century, that social bonds are loosening, and it's harder and harder to get together with others. We find that one of the predictors of happiness in adults and kids is social connections, being with others, but also things like being part of a social activity that meets regularly, like church or like another sort of hobbyist group.
Dr. Dalsgaard, thanks so much for joining us to Add Perspective.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Dr. Catherine Dalsgaard is clinical director of the Anxiety Behaviors Clinic at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. The organization Natural Lands has been preserving open space in Pennsylvania and New Jersey for more than 60 years. The group is most often associated with securing easements on farmland and woodlands, but this weekend they'll open their latest acquisition to the public, a classic mainline estate. WHYY's Kimberly Haas has this preview.
It's a sight you run across from time to time on Philadelphia's main line. As you drive along a leafy street lined with comfortable suburban homes, suddenly there's a really large home, occupying a lot of land, and hearkening back to a different era.
People have driven by this property for years, and it's sort of surrounded by this curtain of tall pine trees and oaks, and they've never really seen what's inside.
That's Ethan Kaufman, director of Stoneleigh, a public garden in Villanova that will soon be opened by Natural Lands. But before being gifted to the conservation group, Stoneleigh was a mainline estate and home of the Haas family. No relation. The gracious stone mansion is surrounded by 42 acres of gardens. Kirsten Werner, director of communications for Natural Lands, says it has famous roots.
It has a long history of being a palette for some really famous landscape architects. In fact, the Olmsted brothers, which were sons of the famous landscape architect who designed Central Park and many other notable features, they have probably the longest recorded history of working on a single property here.
But rather than create a formal, manicured garden with exotic plants, as was fashionable at the time, Kaufman says the Olmsted brothers opted for a more natural feel and let the gardens evolve over time.
It was maintained in a way to allow things to grow as they would. And one of those remarkable things they didn't do was prune all these things formally. They allowed them to grow as they would naturally to create this really unorthodox beauty. And I've run across some lists of the native trees that they've put in here, or just trees in general. And what surprised me is that a full 70% of them were native species back in 1921.
For more than 60 years, Natural Lands has been known for preserving large tracts of open space. Kaufman says their mission still could be applied to this grand estate.
It is a little different, but really the spirit is very much the same. At 42 acres, this is a large tract of land in this area, and so we are conserving land. Our mission is to conserve land, provide stewardship and care for nature, and then also connect people to the natural world. And Stoneleigh really hits on all those principles that we hold dear.
Plus, they're excited to now offer those experiences in a location that's more accessible to more people.
And it presents a really new opportunity for us to engage a lot of different audiences. This is the first property we have that's in a suburban setting like this that's close to a train station. But like all our properties, Stoneleigh will be a free public garden, so this will be able to access freely.
And they decided that ability to reach more people could be a teachable moment, building on the original landscape architect's use of native plant species.
What gardens do in their purest distillation is create joy in people's lives. And it's our hope that when people come here, they'll find a lot of that. But they'll also find some educational opportunities in terms of how they can take a lot of these new species, native plant species, and principles of ecological gardening to their own yards, to their own communities, and create biodiversity, more food for insects, which in turn create more birds and more wildlife.
Natural Lands will open Stoneleigh, a natural garden, to the public on Mother's Day, Sunday, May 13th, with a member preview the day before. Kimberly Haas, WHYY News.
Hunting Park Community Garden's Spring Service Day activities take place this Saturday. Let's get the jump on weeding and mulching with Community Garden Coordinator Mike Wilcox. Mike, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
We'll talk about the garden, but as a lifelong resident, describe this community within North Philadelphia and the changes you've seen over your time there.
Well, my family has been in the community since the 60s with my parents. I grew up there, spent time going to the park, local schools, and walking distance from home. The neighborhood has changed with older. We still have some lifelong older community members. Some of those folks have passed away, unfortunately, and their children are no longer in the community as well. So they sold the property or they may have rented the property. So you have a sense of renters, which may not have been vested in the community like a lifelong resident would have been.
Where there's a pride of ownership, correct. You're describing a situation that might be more transient and then less so.
That's correct. And with the neighboring parks and facilities that may have gone in some disrepair, as well as some of the homes.
Was it in part with that in mind that this garden, this community garden, was created to try to cement relationships and foster a bonding among community members?
Pretty much that was on the residents' minds, but overall the community garden grew out of the overall park revitalization of the Fairmont Park system.
You know, large a space is it?
Well, initially it was 11,000 square feet for the garden space itself.
When did that start?
It was dedicated in 2011, so our first growing season was 2012.
Was it popular right from the start?
It was. We have the park sits between two communities. The traditional Hispanic community is on one side, and the Black African American is on the other side. So it kind of brought those communities together inside the park.
But you sure know what you're growing, and speak to the range of fruits and vegetables that have come up.
Oh, yeah. And then
and flowers, I presume.
Oh, yeah. We have, with the help of last year, just so happened last year, we had the NFL draft. So they wanted to do a community service give back. So they helped to create a monarch way station inside of the garden. Because the migrations of the monarch butterfly go from Canada through this area on down to Mexico.
And then when it comes to edibles?
We have a number of fruit-bearing trees, apples, plums, peaches, figs, persimmons, tart cherries, pie cherries, and a couple of chestnut trees.
Chestnut trees?
We do.
I thought they were all but disappeared in our area. Good to see them coming back.
Yes, yes.
So the specific effort is this Saturday from 9 to 1, but then, of course, it's a long-term endeavor to keep it going.
Right. We're all volunteers, but at times it becomes a full-time job.
So back to the neighborhood and your roots there, can you see in just the few years that the garden and now the orchard have taken root any dividend or benefit regarding the community cohesiveness and perhaps a diminishment in crime?
It has. Police reports show that there is a trend downward in the crime inside of the park and the park activity. With that, the extra foot traffic alone just drives that negative element outside of the perimeter of the park. And we have dog walkers that walk all hours of the night and all more early morning. So you just have that constant flow of people throughout the day. So you don't have that negative element.
Well, I'm sure your community members appreciate your efforts to grow the entire neighborhood.
Yes, yes, I hope they do. And then we always invite people to stop and see and come in and walk around the garden.
Well, with that, thank you so much for taking the time to join us on NewsWorks Tonight, and hope everything goes just great this Saturday.
Thank you very much.
That's Mike Wilcox, coordinator at the Hunting Park Community Garden Spring Service Day this Saturday. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.